Our reading today comes from the book of John, chapter 20, verse 24. Can be found on page 1137 in the Pew Bibles. Now Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe it." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name.
In our morning services, we are exploring passages in the Gospel of John that come after Jesus rose from the dead, after Easter, but then before he ascended to heaven. These 40 days where Jesus was on earth with his new resurrected body. And so we're looking at what did he say, what did he do with his disciples in those days, because that's the season in the church year, where in the year of the church. We're between Easter and Ascension Day. And this morning we come to a passage that is pretty famous as far as these passages go. Often known as Doubting Thomas. Thomas says, "Unless I see Jesus myself, I do not believe that he's really risen from the dead." And often this has been used to think about how we believe and we... Without seeing him, without experiencing it for ourselves. And Jesus says that blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. So almost 2,000 years ago, Jesus rose from the dead. He appears to his disciples in bodily form. He is himself with a new body. He's got this ability to kind of show up places. We looked at this last week. It seems like physical barriers do not harm or hinder the new resurrected body, and we thought about that's probably going to be the case for us as well in the future, as in glory with eternity, having bodies like Christ's resurrected body. It's what 1 Corinthians 15 leads us to believe. Jesus here confronts the person who's become known as Doubting Thomas, who kind of encaptures something that I think many people in our world still cling to today, this idea that seeing is believing, that it is, as long as I can touch it and taste it and feel it and experience it, then I will know, then I will believe. And it's kind of interesting how Jesus responds to this, and so that's what we're going to look at this morning. Before we do that, I want to kind of note that Thomas is also recorded as having lots of faith and following Christ earlier in the Gospel of John. This is the second time Thomas is mentioned by name. And the first time comes in John chapter 11, and this is when Jesus has heard that Lazarus has died. And Jesus tells his disciples, "We're going to go to Judea." And the Gospel of John says the disciples kind of all together said, "That's not a very good idea. Last time you were in Judea, a bunch of Jews tried to stone you to death. Why are we going to go back to Judea?" And then Jesus says, "Lazarus has died." First he says, "Lazarus has fallen asleep." They think he's talking about just sleeping at night like we do. And he said, "No, I mean fallen asleep, died." And so Thomas is recorded in saying in John 11, verse 16, Thomas says, "Let us go that we may die with him." It's Thomas that says, okay, if Jesus is going to face his death, we're going to face our death with him. Thomas, at this moment in his journey with Christ, is convinced and convicted to be with Jesus through the thick and thin. And so Thomas reminds us that the life of discipleship has its ups and downs and its curves. Sometimes we feel so full of conviction, enthusiasm, and faith, and we're going to do anything for Jesus Christ following him. And there's other times we might face a season of, are you there? Do you hear me? Jesus, are you really the risen Lord in my life? Having stories, narratives like this helps us sometimes see ourselves in them and know that the life of faith is not always a nice linear line. It's not an equation. We're not just always taking one more step up to glory. It's sometimes we face valleys. Sometimes we face challenges. For Thomas, at this moment, seeing is believing. And Jesus says, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. So for Jesus, seeing is not the same as believing, but he grants Thomas's request, right? Thomas says, unless I touch his nail scars, unless I see that wounded side, and then what does Jesus do? He says, touch my nail scars, sees my wounded side. Jesus grants his request for evidence, his desire for evidence, but then he says, not everyone's going to be able to have this evidence. Not everyone's going to be able to touch and see in order to believe. Many people will believe based on the witness of these disciples, based on Thomas, based on those who did. You can believe what you hear. You can believe what you read, even if you've not seen it with your own eyes. So I want to talk about the nature of belief a little bit first in our sermon outline, and ask ourselves, why is it that just seeing is not believing? Why is that not a good motto for life? Why did Jesus not only grant Thomas's request, but kind of rebuke him a little bit, say, stop doubting? He did it gently, but he said, stop doubting, believe. This is me. I'm really here. I'm really risen from the dead. See, I hear this from time to time. You probably have heard this too before, that faith in God is a problem today because science has explained so many things. And then people will go on to make this claim that we shouldn't believe things we cannot observe or test or measure. So by definition, people say what you should believe doesn't include God. By definition, because we can't test and measure God. But that definition is lacking. Why is this wrong? How could we be missing the boat if we think this way? How could it be that so many people have the wrong idea about the nature of belief? And I think a lot of people say things like this not because they've thought through it, But they've heard someone else say that, and they think that someone else is fairly smart, so they kind of adopt it as their own kind of guide for life. But if you really work at this, if you really analyze it and look at it from all sides, this idea does not work. Many of you probably believe that the moon is not made out of cheese, right? But you haven't been there to see it for yourself. You haven't tasted moon rock to make sure it's not cheese. There's a funny Wallace and Gromit episode where they think it's made out of cheese and they make a rocket ship and go there and they're trying it out and putting on their crackers and stuff and it's pretty disappointing cheese to them, right? There are silly things people can believe, and there's reasons not to believe them. And we believe them because we've had witnesses go there and say, yeah, this is what it's made of. Most people believe that Aristotle and Plato were philosophers that lived years ago and had some very fascinating and life, earth-changing ideas that they taught. We believe that because we have old records and copies of what they wrote. We have other people quoting them from the ancient world. But no one doubts that they existed. No one doubts that they meant what they taught. They believed what they taught. But the fact is we have like a thousand times more manuscripts that are just as old of the Bible. And somehow people say, well, that's not true. That can't be trustworthy. The people who wrote the Bible had to have some kind of hidden agenda. They're leading us astray. Jesus never actually lived. Actually, any smart person cannot say that Jesus never lived. I've heard some people even say this, but there's more evidence that Jesus of Nazareth was alive than any other person in the ancient world. And everybody agrees, even the critical scholars, that he did die at the hand of Rome. The question everyone debates is, did he rise again? But we believe he did based on testimony, based on witnesses, based on those who experienced the evidence themselves. See, the thing about trust is you need to trust in order to build trust. You need to show love in order to grow the love between two people. You need to believe in order to grow in your belief. And I know that we believe a lot based on the witness and testimony of others. Most college students that come to deny or think that science or something can explain away life and we don't need God, we don't need to factor in how God has shaped history. We could just see it all as human stuff. Most of them believe that based on the witness of a professor or a human. They haven't actually analyzed it all themselves. They haven't done all their own research. They just trust someone else's testimony. So most people believe things that they can't measure or prove based on their trust of other people. So religious belief and secular belief actually isn't all that different when you look at it from an objective, unbiased standpoint. The other thing about belief is it actually hinders us to use a scientific model for it. I remember when John Polkinghorne, who is a physicist from England, who also got his PhD in theology, and now he's an Anglican priest. He was an elementary particle physicist. He says there's a lot more to explore about the nature of God than there is explore the nature of matter. And he gave a talk once, and I'll never forget this. It kind of changed the way I approached things for a while. He said, if you're always testing a relationship, you'll actually undermine the relationship. And I've thought about this and maybe some encounters of some marriage counseling along the way have helped me put together how to make this concrete. If you have a husband and a wife and you have a wife that she is really sick of him working late. He's working late all the time. And she's thinking that this means he's not very committed to her. Because he's working so much, sometimes he doesn't get home in time for dinner. So what she's going to do is she's going to kind of test the relationship by dropping really decoded, subtle hints that she wants him home more often. And the test is if he picks up on these hints, he loves her, and if he doesn't, he must not. Now that's a terrible way to try to grow your relationship. All the time, the husband is thinking, my job's kind of insecure. My boss told me the other day that he could replace me if he needed to if I didn't get my act together. He's putting in his time because he loves his wife. And he doesn't understand her little hints and her little games. And so he's failing the test. And he loves her and he's committed to her, but he wants to be the breadwinner and he's providing. So he's working a lot and she's missing him and they're going apart because they're using this kind of testing each other out. What's required is actually a move of vulnerability, a move of trust, in order to build trust. What's required of the wife is to actually be vulnerable enough to say, I'm really hurt when you're at home at night, and especially when I have to sit and eat this meal alone, I'm heartbroken. When we said I do at the altar, I expected we'd at least have this time together each and every day. And I miss it because I miss you. What's required is an act of love to kind of get going and work on that relationship. And also in the husband's case, what's required is an act of love, not let's try something out and see what she does, but for him to be honest with her about how work has been. And say, I'm feeling very insecure about this job. I'm not even sure I enjoy it anymore because my boss is very demanding, but I need to keep it before I find something else. And I need to put in this time for now, and let's figure out how to work together, and I'll be more sensitive and I'll call ahead and I'll plan better. And so there's some giving and taking, but it requires vulnerability at the beginning in order to grow in love. It requires an act of love in order to grow love. And it requires an act of trust. I'm going to bear my soul and trust you with it in order to build trust. And that's the way all relationships work, and that's the way our relationship with Christ works. Our relationship with God works. You can't expect to kind of throw these little tests out to God, and if he passes, he's real, and if he fails, he's not. That's not the way anyone grows in their walk with the Lord. So Thomas kind of approaches his relationship with Christ this way, right? The disciples say, we have seen him. Judas is missing, Thomas is missing. There's 10 disciples, 10 witnesses, which, by the way, 10, that's interesting, because that's, if you have 10 witnesses, you've got a clear court case in the ancient world. There's no way you should be doubting. 10 witnesses around him saying, we have seen the Lord, and Thomas says, nope, I've got to see it myself. I've got to test it myself. He wants evidence, right? And so we've talked about the nature of belief a little bit. Everyone's belief is based on witness testimony. Everyone's belief is based on third-party trusts. And there's no way that we can grow in our beliefs that are connected with relationships by just applying science and testing and analysis. Does require vulnerability and a human connection, a human trust, to place faith in someone in order to grow your faith in someone. So what about our doubts? What about Thomas's doubts? Because we do want evidence, and I think God grants us that request often. Jesus grants it to Thomas. Thomas says, unless this and unless that, and Jesus comes and says, here you go. Put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Some of you have talked to me before about having a challenging few weeks, and then the Lord does something in your life that an unbeliever would call coincidence. But you're convinced that this was God giving you a little evidence that he is there. And he is still with you and he is still caring for you. I think God still does that today. He still grants us evidence. He still speaks to us through the kind words of each other sometimes. Or he'll put something in our day that just seemed so unlikely, but It did happen. It seemed like a God thing. God does grant us our inherent need for some kind of evidence. Some of us, perhaps here, are like Thomas's, the doubting Thomas's today. We've talked about Easter, we've sang a bunch of songs, but we're still struggling to believe that. That doesn't seem feasible, that Christ was risen from the dead. But there's a chance that there's some of you, some of us here today, that we don't have the Thomas problem, we have a different problem. We say we believe, but we don't live like it. Profession just becomes something, a mouth only, and life is not backing any of it up. There is a difference between professed belief and actual belief. What we say we believe and what we actually believe is proven. The metal is in our actions, in our daily attitudes, in our words, the way we treat others. Do we live like Christ is risen, or do we just say Christ is risen and live like there's no hope in the world, like there's no hope for the future? Thomas's professed belief in verse 28 cannot leave us with a Jesus who's just a good idea, just a wise guy, just a man who taught some good things and then had a tragic end. Thomas says, "My Lord and my God." Thomas says that this risen Christ who's in front of him, who just showed him his hands and his side, is not just a man. He's not just a human being. He's God himself. And Jesus doesn't say, "Oh, nope, you've gone too far." He doesn't correct him. He doesn't guide him. He says, "You've believed in me, and blessed are those who haven't seen and yet believe." Is our professed belief that Jesus Christ is not only a good advisor, not only a friend, but the Lord of the universe, the Lord of our lives, the King of kings, the Lord of lords. Is Jesus really in charge of everything else that could come in your way this week and trip you up? Is Jesus Christ really bigger and more powerful than death itself, so we don't have to fear? Our last breath doesn't have to be a scary, daunting, paralyzing thing. We can live life to the fullest because we don't have to live life in fear of that inevitable conclusion to all of our lives. We can experience and explore this world and love one another to the full throttle that we can in our life because Christ has conquered the grave and he's appeared to his disciples and he said, "Peace be with you." Have shalom. Have peace with God. Jesus is gracious in his response to our doubts. If you're doubting today, I would encourage you to put those doubts into prayer. Bring them before God. Tell him what you're having trouble believing, how you're having trouble following him. Jesus is gracious in his response to our doubts. Even when we ask for things that aren't purely perfect motives, he sometimes grants them to give us encouragement. Do you believe in Jesus and are you experiencing life in his name? New life connected to the risen Christ. We have a representative of our humanity before the throne of God. There is humanity in the presence of deity, so we can have a restored relationship with God through Jesus Christ, who rose again, who gives us peace, who shows us he is alive in the ways that we need to see it. And he says, "Blessed are you who have not seen me physically, yet you have believed."